I think maybe for some of you it may be helpful if I take just a moment to tell you where I come from on some of this. I am an ordained Lutheran pastor, but I've never worked at it very hard. I've never worked at anything else very hard either. But I've served parishes for just a very minor fraction of my professional career. But I was a theological professor for 15 years or so. Before that, I had been a therapist for about 10 years. After coming out of the Navy and graduate school. And then when a new hospital was going to open up in Chicago, or when they were starting to plan it, they asked if I would come down and play some role in relationship to that hospital. And my immediate answer was no, that I wouldn't. They asked me why, and I told them it was because I didn't believe in church-related hospitals. That shocked them enough. So that instead of just taking my answer and looking for somebody that was a little bit more courteous, at least, they came up to see me and we started to have some conversations up in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I got hooked because these people were willing to take a look at the possible ways in which health care needed modification. And most specifically, perhaps church-related health care. My reason for not being interested in church-related hospitals at the time was that it was so desperately hard for me to find any evidences in church-related hospitals that the way in which the health care took place, the stuff of it, if you please, was no different from that at any other institution. And it seemed to me there ought to be a difference. Now, I was told a lot of things about, well, there's a different spirit around here, and I am all in favor of different spirit, by what they mean by that. It's a very real thing. It talks about dedication, and perhaps talks about concern, and it talks about maybe a different kind of compassion. I wouldn't want to stretch those differences between Christian and non-Christian institutions too far at that point, but I think there may be a case that can be made for some differences. But so much had been taking place in the 30s and 40s and then into the 50s that was suggesting a new approach to health care that I thought raised theological questions, and serious ones. And if the church wasn't picking these up in its institutions, then I didn't think we should go through the motions of running an institution that was supposedly different. Or, worse, that had failed to pick up the responsibilities that were suggested out of the new findings in biology, and in particularly in molecular biology, but in all kinds of fields related to the understanding of the nature of the human being and the way in which he functions in health and in illness. Well, at any rate, I went down as a consultant, agreeing to stay for a few months. Then that was changed into a year, which stretched into 2 years. I resigned from the seminary faculty and dove in headfirst and stayed for 20 years working in a hospital that was a somewhat unusual institution, part of the unusual in that institution was that they were willing to make me a vice president in charge of doing whatever I pleased. Not many institutions will do that with me or probably with anybody else. But I had an opportunity that was a rare one indeed to work with other concerned people, people out of all the related disciplines, pooling our concerns and our understandings and our knowledge, bringing them together, focusing on the questions of how does a church hospital function. The church part of it kind of became the least of our preoccupation, not because it was the least important or anything, but because we had prior questions, and they came to things like this: what is a patient? We're going to build a fancy new hospital, and we thought we better start out with a question, what is a patient? And we came to the fantastic discovery one day that a patient is a human being. That hadn't quite occurred, I think, to us before that, because there's something about dealing with categories that makes it very difficult for you not to see the person interpreted by the category. And the category was patient. So there were all kinds of things that we, quote, knew then about this person, because hospitals have been going for quite some time, and they've had patients, and patients have been described and re-described in one way or another. But we went back to something we thought quite basic and looked for answers to the question then of what is a human being? And that's not so easy to come by. While man has had this fantastic explosion of knowledge in these past couple of decades, or three decades or so, just fantastic explosion, implemented by transistors and by the chips and by the computers that have been made possible by those things. While man has been exploding this knowledge and being able to sort it out and codify it and arrange it and make it somewhat more accessible than it would have been otherwise, we have concentrated the effects of that knowledge into some rather strictly defined and described areas that carry over probably more from the past than from the new data or the new understandings. But certain people in certain disciplines, certain professions, certain technologies were digging deeper and deeper and deeper into the nature of man. Now, when they were doing this, they were doing it largely independently, because if there's anything that characterizes man's search for knowledge, it is the way in which he ignores the guy doing the same kind of a thing right now alongside of him. So little cooperation, so little communication across disciplinary lines. So that the psychiatrists were starting to think some things about the nature of human being that were really interesting. I suppose probably based pretty largely in Freud, though it's hard to find it in its more obvious and overt sense in Freud, but the implications of Freud's contributions to our understanding of what a human being is were touched psychiatry off into directions that were broader than the narrower confines of what had been known as mental illness, and touched into the way in which the way we think and the way we feel about things affects the functioning of the human body. Then, at the same time, the biologists were beginning to discover that from the angleworm on, or wherever they did start, you couldn't really understand the matter of life, the body, the physical, unless you understood a whole lot more that was non-physical. That you couldn't take a cell, for instance, even, in cytology, the science of cells has done a great deal here. They couldn't understand that cell without understanding the organism from which the cell was drawn and the effect of non-cell factors influences upon the way in which the cell functioned. Now, there's a great deal of modification in the way our cells function. When we are happy as over against when we are sad, or when we are afraid as over against when we're walking in courage, there's a good deal of difference in the way the cells function. One of the later things in cytology, you know, cells, you got to look at through microscopes and sometimes electron microscopes to make any sense out of them at all. They're so small. But it used to be thought, more because it was assumed than on any hard evidence, that every cell had a little skin around it, like a membrane or something, that made it largely impervious to anything from the outside. That protected its integrity. Well, more recently, and I think this is within the last 8 years or so, and most people still wouldn't believe it, and a lot of people working with cells still wouldn't believe it unless they have themselves been confronted with the evidence that there is no membrane around the cell at all, or on most of the cells. There's only a field around it. And that field is more closely related to electricity and chemistry than it is to something physical like a membrane. And that the polarities and the nature of that field that maintains the cell integrity, kind of holds it together and defines it and describes it, that is deeply modified by these things, as I say, the way we think and the way we feel about things, and that perhaps, now the immunologists were beginning to say something on the basis of that. The immunologist says, hey, now that starts to open up the door for some possibilities, because we notice that sometimes people are far more susceptible to disease than they are at other times. If you take all the common colds in this world, you'd find a marked difference between the emotional mood in the day or two before the cold of the people who have colds and those who don't have colds, or those same people when they don't get a cold afterwards. You're more apt to get a cold if you're feeling irritated or sad or confused or mixed up or afraid or whatever. You're more apt to even get just a common cold. The least understood of all the diseases, I guess. It's kind of fun to have one like that has been around and is the most common of all, and we don't know anything about it yet. No. The old thing used to be a gag, I guess, from the day the first medical school opened, that if you treat the common cold intensively, you know, with a lot of citric acid and now it's vitamin C, I guess, that they dump into you, and you take all kinds of stuff for your nose and keep it from dripping down, you don't get the sore throat part of it, all that kind of business, you treat it intensively, it'll be gone in 7 days. And if you don't do anything, it'll be gone in 7 days. And that's about the way it works on the cold. We don't know a great deal about it. But the cytologist and the immunologist became quite interested and said maybe the reason that certain diseases are apparently on a drastic uprise in incidence is because immunological mechanisms are breaking down, and this could be a possible explanation of why they're breaking down. That tension tends, perhaps, to do something to the integrity of the cell, making it more permeable than it would have been otherwise, and therefore less protected. If it doesn't have that cellophane wrapping around it, but has something that is at that borderline between the material and something that is kind of non-material. What's electricity? Is that material or is that non-material? There's a great deal of electricity that's involved in a cell. a great deal of electricity in a heartbeat. Heartbeat comes about when the cells, the little tiny cells in the heart, microscopic cells in the heart, leak out sodium and take in potassium, and in this oozing out, leaking out process, they build a charge of electricity in the cell. And between every heartbeat, now while we've been just talking about the heartbeats now, it's happened many times, it's happened thousands of times, for as far as the whole group is concerned, huh? Just in a minute or so. With each one of us 60, 70 times every minute. And each time that heartbeat, there's been this interchange between potassium and sodium, leaving a little charge of electricity, like a storage battery picks up a little bit in a similar chemical exchange. Now, excitement will make this happen much faster. Certain other conditions will make it happen much slower and slows it down. I'm not talking about the involvement of drugs at this point at all. Now, one section of the heart does this a little bit faster than the rest of the heart, and so that one, having reached full charge, a little, just a tiny fraction of a second ahead of the others, explodes. Spontaneous sparking, as it were. Stimulating the muscles so that the whole thing clamps down like this. Bang. That's the heartbeat. And the whole thing starts over again and builds up. And this can be greatly modified. Our brain cells work in this chemoelectric system that can be very much modified by what we think and what we feel and how much courage or lack of it we have as we walk through life. All right, a lot of these people were making their investigations and finding a whole lot more about the nature of human life. The biologists were finding a whole lot more. The whole new science of molecular biology was coming into being. The psychiatrists were beginning to apply their understanding of the psychology of the human being in much broader terms, with deeper involvement into the physical than what they had understood before. And all kinds of little specialties were beginning, and subspecialties were beginning to grow up. But the deepest, most profound thinkers, the ones who went the furthest with these investigations, began to say, hey, we are finding some things here that we must talk about together, because the deeper we go into these new understandings of the human being, the more we find that our lines of discovery converge on each other and they meet at a simple understanding. The human being is complex, made up of many aspects, but is indivisible in nature. And the whole Cartesian concept of a nicely dividable man, you remember Descartes sitting in a steam chamber one night, or day, I got a foggy notion, if you'll excuse the pun, but I think it's an appropriate place for Cartesian view of man to come, is in the fog. But it defined man. He defined man as composed of body and mind and soul, and he went on to do a better job than the ancients had done of making these kind of separable. And all human institutions have suckered in on that one, including the church. The hospitals take a body and run off with that and say, we'll take care of that one, and pay precious little attention until recently to anything else but the body. The church runs off with a soul and takes it before an altar and pays very little attention to the physical needs, for instance. The school says, give us your brains. And if the kid comes to school malnourished, they don't even know it, usually. Or if he has some physical handicap that may prevent his learning. Not only prevent his learning, but may knock him so out of shape because he can't learn, he's learned to be a dummy and think of himself as a dummy, that he never recovers. And the world is full of those cripples who have been taught because of perhaps some rather simple deficiency that may be physical, for instance, or maybe something else also, may have been physical in nature, has altered the way the person thinks about himself, destroyed confidence, and made it so he never did learn anything and couldn't make use of then the usual learning processes towards advancement and growing up. I speak with some feeling at this one because I was one of them. I practically failed every grade in spite of the fact through much of my early schooling, we lived in small, very small towns, and my dad was a preacher, and I think teachers were a little bit reluctant to flunk the teacher's kid until I got in the fifth grade, when my fifth grade teacher was more courageous than the rest, and she failed me, and I had to take the whole year over again. And it doesn't do you any good to have that kind of an experience. If it hadn't been for a mother and father who somehow or another kept my self-esteem alive in spite of it, I would have been, I think, utterly destroyed by it. Now, it's a tragic thing that schools and hospitals and churches and families don't get into closer communication with each other. Particularly now that hospitals have all this fancy computerized equipment for running simple tests on people that can show up a lot of things, determine them, find them if they're there, and you can do mass screenings that are very helpful on eyesight, on hearing. Now, these are done, but they're done usually in fragmentary ways instead of doing them the efficient way. If the hospital was in close relationship to the school, it could be done very, very easily. To run some simple tests and analyses in hematology, that we have machines that will run off for about 23 different things in the blood out of not much more than a drop of blood in the tiniest, tiniest little test tubes, and spin this stuff off and come out and print it out on paper just what the analysis of the blood is. It'd be a good thing if all school kids had this, and you'd pick up a lot of things, including early leukemia, for instance, if you want to take a more dramatic one, and get treatment started. And if treatment is started early in these days with leukemia, you've made some great advances, a great deal more possibility of cure. Well, this was about where we were when we planned this new hospital. So we staffed up differently, and we're not going to spend time on Lutheran General Hospital other than just to say this is where I'm coming from. On this. We have had now 20 years of experience with the development of and the practice of, as far as it is possible, or was possible for us, to practice a truly holistic approach to medical care. We didn't call it holistic because we have some problems with that word, because it also has some other meanings, and you have to kind of undo the other meanings. So we went to a tougher word like ecology and called ecological care, and that didn't give us any problem until all of a sudden ecology started to get used as another word. You have to go back now 23 years ago when we started to use the term ecology to describe, or ecological to describe, the approach to health care, which simply, taken from the Greek word oikos, means total or whole. Now, but we are caught up in a system, and the system is one that has values. And the value system says cure is where we put our bucks, our money. Now, that sounds all right, doesn't it, to be cured? That sounds like a good, positive, strong word. It's one of the of our great deficits in health care, that we have geared ourselves almost exclusively to cure instead of to healing. And I'm going to have to untangle that mess, I know. Now, it's based on a differentiation between disease, a concept of disease, and a concept of illness. I have to be a little bit arbitrary, but I think that this is the way the words are being used, so it isn't all that arbitrary on my part. We cure diseases. If it is illness that we're talking about, perhaps that's a word that refers to the person, and the person is ill. And for illness, you need healing. I think it becomes most apparent if you hang around a hospital for over a period of years, or a doctor's office over a period of years, and see people come in with what may be even apparently totally unrelated diseases, strung out like an unholy rosary across the days of their life, and never quite get well. Psychiatry comes in and is of enormous help here in pointing out some exaggerated cases of this, where the person just needs to be ill and produces a genuine illness out of the need to be ill. Now, those are rare and I think few and far between where it is that obvious. Maybe we all do it to a little extent. But the money that we have spent in health care, and it's an enormous amount, has gone into the development of knowledge, the application of the knowledge, the development of the gadgetry. And the use of the gadgetry of curative medicine. Now, let me give you an example of what I mean. A woman came into our hospital one day, unconscious, brought in by one of these fancy new, very efficient ambulances, with a well-trained crew of medics aboard, been called to a house, and they were there within 3 or 4 minutes with this fine thing. They ran into the house with very sophisticated stuff. They knew what they were doing. They resuscitated the woman so she was breathing again, and her heart was going, though still unconscious. They put in a couple of jacks on the instruments they had, and the cardiologist back at the hospital took a look and saw what the heartbeat looked like 3 miles away. It's great stuff. It gives you a lot of kind of a security feeling when, if you've got a little coronary heart disease or coronary artery disease or something of that nature, when you know that at least this thing is possible. They brought her in there, and she had had a coronary. And she was in our hospital for 3.5 weeks, and then we pronounced her ready to go home. Now, when she was in there, she was monitored almost every minute of the day. Somebody's eye was going over day and night. Somebody's eye was going over a bank of monitors, and well-trained people, and when any of the beats got out of shape, were drawn irregularly, right away, they let somebody know. Now we've got fancier ones than that. They actually tip off little signals. Red lights go on or buzzers go when the heartbeat gets out of shape, signifying that something is going wrong with that heart. Well, this woman was on monitoring, and whenever she got into a little trouble, right away they could come and correct some medication to counteract this thing. Very sophisticated coronary care unit. Had everything. Well-trained people, all the latest stuff with which to read and to know what was going on in that mysterious organ called the heart. So after 3.5 weeks, she was ready to go home, and everybody complimented her on her good recovery, and she went home. I happened to have seen her just in seeing another patient and went over to say hello to this woman, and she didn't seem all that happy to me about going home. And I said to the nurse when I was going out the door, "What gives with Mrs. Jones? She doesn't seem to be very happy about going home." And she said, "No, for the last 2-3 days she hasn't." And we didn't tumble that she was saying something to us and saying something very important to us. Or she came back the next morning again. She went home that day, but she came back the next morning, but dead on arrival. Well, obviously, we hadn't healed or cured. When we then started to go to work to say, how in the world could this have happened? Now, you know it can happen, and you can't guarantee life to everybody perpetually. You know that. But on the other hand, you sure beat yourself up, and you have to. If you're going to act responsibly, you have to say, how could this happen? We sent her home. She should have been well. At least she should have been more well than she obviously was. But we had cured instead of healed. Now listen. What we had done was we had gone in to that situation, to that heart, with all the modern technology to straighten out the beating of the heart. When we got that chemistry going right, so that that heart was moving the way it ought to move, we let her go home cured. What we didn't know anything about, and that was our fault, we should have, because we were geared up for it. We have 35 social workers in that hospital. We have 36 full-time, specially trained chaplains in that hospital. And then other ancillary team members in proportion to this. Now, that's an enormous difference between what you find in an average hospital. I think, you know, what's that? 800 beds. But we had that many chaplains and that many social workers when we were only 550 beds. Now, so we're staffed up, you see, for a whole man treatment, treating more than the physical. But we didn't catch something. Somehow or another, when this woman didn't want to talk to individuals or didn't raise with individuals or in groups, because all the coronary care or coronary patients go through some group therapy. They sit with their, peers, as it were, other coronary people who help each other, much as the way Alcoholics Anonymous people help each other. They sit down and tell each other what it's like to have a heart attack, and the denial part of it is much easier handled by people who have been through it and say, yes, I deny it also, but you're not going to get yourself well if you just keep on denying and saying, well, I didn't really have a heart attack, or mine came because I had a very unusual stress at the moment. Then they talk about straightening out your life and getting things organized a little bit better and finding ways to introduce values into life that'll keep you excited and moving and motivated. Most people die of boredom anyway, I think, if they die in unusual circumstances and too early. Well, and surely most people come into a hospital out of boredom. If you take the people who are in any hospital on any given day, at least 50% of them wouldn't be there if they were excited about something. I'm absolutely convinced of that.
But why, if you sit around wondering what's going to happen next week, why, something's going to go haywire, as sure as can be, you know, because at least it brings a little drama into life, huh? Better than sitting there moping around. And a lot of people have to do that. And they may be physically very active, and that may sometimes be the tip-off. They're too active. They're when they get activistic and just frantically active, it may be because they're bored stiff and they're searching like a bumblebee looking for nectar. And when he can't find it, he gets a little bit frantic. Or like the hummingbirds on our front deck in Leavenworth, when we start cutting off the sugar water supply to get them hardened up for going home across the Gulf of Mexico, they go frantic for a while, looking all over for the place. And it's an interesting picture of human beings running frantically to try to find something of meaning, something of significance, something of joy, something to which they can attach their lives. Well, I'm quite certain that we could get along with half the hospitals we've got or half the size in them, or do twice as much while they're there if we could get rid of the factor of boredom. Now, don't take this to mean that everybody who is sick is there out of boredom. You understand what I'm saying. I'm saying half of them are. And I think I'm conservative in that kind of an estimate. All right, this woman was dead when she came back. Just as dead as if we hadn't treated her for those 3.5 weeks. What we didn't know was that her 12-year-old daughter made $13,000 the year before peddling cocaine in the Main East parking lot, and she wasn't even going to that school yet. She was still in grade school, in junior high school. She was selling cocaine, not even using it. She had used it a few times, but she had found that somebody who said, "Hey, you know, you want to make some money, I can show you how you can make some money. I'll supply it. You peddle it. They won't suspect you." And in about 4 different bank accounts around the western suburbs, northwest suburbs of Chicago, she had $13,000 that she didn't even dare spend because somebody would discover what she was doing. But she had been caught a few times recently, before her mother's first heart attack. But somehow or another, the father decided that he didn't think that the mother should be bothered with this information. So he hadn't told her anything about it. "No, she'd just get too excited," he said. Being a very influential guy, he somehow or another managed to get to the judge that was hearing one of these cases and had him cover it. She had to go to a detention home for a few days or so, but she wasn't sent further away, and he could cover the short-term removal from the home by saying that she was going to go and visit somebody, and kept this from the mother. The night before she had her first heart attack, the mother was sitting there by herself reading at about 10:30 at night. There was a knock on the door, and policemen were standing there and with a warrant to... No. They came and they had a warrant to search the girl's room. Well, why? Well, she's been involved in the drugs again. What do you mean she's been involved in the drugs again? You got the wrong house, the wrong person. My daughter's never been involved in anything like this. Well, isn't your daughter? And they had the papers right there. So they went up to the room, and sure enough, here they found some of the stuff in her room and other evidence than the cocaine itself that she was peddling. Now, that's what the mother experienced the night before her heart attack. When she came back home, nothing had been done about this, either by the hospital, hadn't gotten into it and helped her to live with the situation. We hadn't healed the home. We hadn't healed the little girl. We hadn't healed this panty-waist husband who couldn't face up to his wife's possible hysteria when she found out about this. So when she gets back home, she didn't have to have another great big blow. She was simply back at the source of her illness, of which the heart attack was a symptom. It's a sad thing. Not only because that woman died, and perhaps unnecessarily, but because all you'd have to do is look through the records of any hospital, and you'll find this repeated over and over and over again, that we treat the symptoms superficially. We attach our significance and our intents towards organs and forget that the disease arises out of and exists in the context of a total person, his total life, the inseparable interaction of all of these dynamics working together. Now, it takes a little theology to straighten the thing out, because if we believe that a human being is a body that has also a mind, that has also a soul, I don't think we're going to come to the point where we really get at healing. When we see the human being as being body, being mind, being soul, being emotions, being reason and relationships, if he is all of these things. Now, we've really messed up our theology, because the cultural understanding of man accepted commonly in our culture as a divisible being has made us read the New Testament particularly kind of backwards. It's only recently that the biblical scholars have come around and reminded us, hey, wait a minute. The anthropology of Scripture, that is the doctrine of man, or the presentation of the truths about man in Scripture, do not allow for this division. They speak only of the totality. If you want just a simple one to start with, you know, God formed man out of the dust of the ground. What that means, I don't know, and I don't suppose anybody else does either. But at any rate, he formed man out of the stuff of the planet, out of the matter. What that is supposed to represent, I don't know. Whether it was that he actually did a sculpturing act and then quickened it into life, that's permissible to believe that. If it's that out of the primordial ooze he drew through a long process of millions of years, that is permissible. Within Christian theology, time is not of the essence. But whatever is involved in that he breathed into our nostrils the breath of life, and so man became a living soul, that is of the essence. Something, whenever that took place, however it took place, that which is talked about in that first chapter of Genesis, the breathing into by God, made us become, well, the interesting thing is we became souls, huh? Now, you can't translate it that way anymore, because we've taken the word soul, given at Cartesian meetings, and it ends up meaning a fraction of the human being, so the translators had to take these beautiful terms that come out and related to something that in Hebrew is the nefesh kaya, a very rich concept of livingness, unique liveness. You take that and say something began at that point that is distinctive.
And say something began at that point that is distinctive from all other kinds of life and all other kinds of matter. Now, the word was soul, but you can't go back and use it, because that's still the best translation. That was the old King James translation. But because if we use the word soul, most of us think of it as being some part of a human being, huh? Instead of being a word that means the human being, the total. That's what we became. And so man became the nephesh chayah. Man became the living soul. That's the scripture. Now, they went around and said, and man became a living being. That was the first new translation after the King James. Well, that's ridiculous. So is an ant, so is an angleworm, so is a rattlesnake, so is a dog. You know, so are the little puppies that were born down my basement the other day. You know, they're all living beings. Soul is a great, respectable word, and it's a good word to be used instead of person. We are persons. So man became a person. A dog is still a dog, but a person is a person. A human is a person. Now, a person is a magnificent, combination of intermingled, inseparable dynamics that are physical and emotional and spiritual and all of these things, that are ways that you can talk about man and ways that you can look at man without being part. Man doesn't have a soul. Man is a soul. Man doesn't have a body. He is a body. Man doesn't have emotion. He is emotional, and so on. And we have to come out some new way of talking. We have to put words together differently so that we can convey these things and understand them about ourselves. Illness. Yeah. I'm not talking about disease now. Illness is when these things get to be unglued and unhooked. Perhaps we could say that the illness from which man suffers is his brokenness. That brokenness may take many different forms. Maybe he's got a broken bone. Okay, he's got a broken bone. But if you've got a broken bone, it isn't just a simple broken bone. Because you don't say when you're trying to, well, like drag yourself down from two mountains up the road, like Dave Christian did the other night. Came in here at 12 o'clock after walking 12 hours on a broken kneecap. It's got to be hard to do. But Dave, the next day in the hospital, wasn't saying, when I said, "How are you, Dave?" Well, yeah, stupid question. Guy had just awakened after something like a night's sleep after all that pain and that 12-hour ordeal coming down from way up there. But he gave me some kind of an answer that I deserved, like, "How do you suppose I am?" or something like that. But he didn't say, "Oh, Fritz, I'm just fine. I'm great. I'm top of the world. My leg is having trouble, but I'm fine." You know? No way. He just hurt. It happened to be focalized in the leg. But he hurt. It was Dave Christian hurting. Not just a leg hurting. Not just a body hurting. Dave hurt. One way to understand this, I think, is in a longer perspective. And Arnie Cirilla, who is the brother of Marty Cirilla, these two are Finnish guys, and it's hard to tell which one is the psychoanalyst and which one is the Lutheran theologian. They worked together, very closely together for a long time. And Marty, the psychiatrist of the brothers, says that Arnie is by far the better psychoanalyst. And Arnie, the theologian, says that his brother knows more theology than he'll ever learn. And I think they're almost right in there. But Arnie wrote a book that's really the work of both of them, entitled The Voice of the Illness, saying we better listen to what our illnesses say about it, because there's something exceedingly important to learn about the nature of ourselves from the nature of our illnesses, about the nature of society from the nature of our illnesses. He calls attention, for instance, to the, as an analogy, to witchcraft in Salem, Massachusetts, a couple centuries ago. And he said, now, at that time, the witches were the sick ones. They were evil, even. But equate that with sickness.